Is it just me, or is it really hot in here? Well, I'm really honored to have been invited by David Thoreau and the Independent Institute to share the podium with so distinguished a legal scholar, especially after he calls me a man of perfect virtue.
I knew you were commenting on it.
And I do want to make one minor correction in my intro. I'm a former national fellow at the Hoover Institution. That was a year appointment, which ended over a year ago. But I am still a visiting scholar at the Social Science History Institute, which is at Stanford and related to Hoover. One thing I like to often do in my presentations is survey the audience. So can I see a show of hands? How many in the audience consider themselves either libertarians or classical liberals? Well, so Richard's right. We are among friends. And that gives me an excellent excuse to focus on the weaknesses of his position and his latest book rather than the strengths.
Attack from the right.
That's right. Now, before I do so, I want to emphasize that I do admire this book. I think it is always interesting and challenging and sometimes even inspired. It attempts to do two vital tasks. One is to ground classical liberalism in some solid theoretical and empirical foundations, and the other is to defend it from some of the more recent sophisticated criticisms, philosophical, psychological, and empirical, of people like Amartya Sen, Gerald Cohen, Robert Frank, and some of the behavioral economists. And in fact, one of my favorite parts of the book comes in chapter 9, where Richard offers a Hayekian perspective on the efficient market hypothesis, and that I may assign to some of my students, some of whom are in the audience. Now, did I get points for that?
Yes.
If I were to pick the book of Richard's that sort of summarizes his research agenda in its title, it would be Simple Rules for a Complex World. And there are two tiers or levels at which Richard seems to be pursuing that goal. One at the level of law, law between individuals, and one at the level of government, simple rules confining government. So I have really two related problems with Richard's position. One is that his simple rules for a complex world, as they apply to government, are not simple enough. And the second argument is that the justification he gives for government is caught in an inner contradiction. No one has ever accused Richard of being an anarchist or being a consistent opponent of a taxation. And in Takings, Richard enunciated the simple rule that that he has repeated here, basically that government is not allowed to intervene unless the gains exceed the losses, and the losers have to be compensated. And what has always disturbed me about this rule is not some of the standard objections that you might get from other critics. It's not his reliance upon the economic concept of efficiency as a normative standard, nor is it in his consequentialist approach to these problems. I've always found the consequentialist natural rights controversy in large part a semantic quibble with no substantive content. Richard, in a recent debate with two anarchists, David Friedman and Randy Barnett, concluded after the debate that we are all consequentialists now. And I think that if you read the libertarian natural rights, read closely the modern libertarian natural rights theorists like Rothbard, Rand, McCann, and George Smith, we've always been consequentialist all along, at least in a certain sense. My objection to his rule is that it is not simple enough to frame an effective bulwark against state power. And I'm going to pick one issue out of the laundry list of essential government functions that Richard gave us to explore this weakness, and that's antitrust. Now, I don't know, Richard may clarify this later, but I get the impression from reading Skepticism and Freedom that he's actually changed his position slightly, because the standard neoclassical objection to monopoly is that it's inefficient. which is to say that it produces the wrong quantity of output. But in Skepticism and Freedom, Richard seems to be objecting to monopoly because it charges too high a price. And that segues into suggested regulations of price discrimination. Now this, for an economist, is a slippery slope. Nearly every principles text will tell you that price discrimination, which is pervasive in the modern economy, is a primary way of eliminating the inefficiency of monopoly. And in fact, if you've got a firm that is that can engage in perfect price discrimination, perfectly efficient, but using Richard's criterion, or as I understand it, it would be bad because it would capture nearly all the consumer surplus. Now, again, it's hard to gauge how far Richard is willing to go on this antitrust issue, and my reading of the book may be that all he wants is the common law refusal to enforce contracts and restraint of trade, and that's certainly a loophole that most of us can live with, in part because it's pretty much non-binding. Firms can get around that through merger. And so if you're really serious about antitrust, you got to move from not enforcing the contracts to government regulations of mergers. And it seems to me that we're now in an issue where there is no obvious bright line, no shelling point. Where does it stop? And if I can't even figure out from reading Richard's book how to translate this into an understandable rule that's simple, how can the business community do so? On the whole issue of antitrust, I'm reminded, I realize this is invoking authority, but I'm reminded of one Thanksgiving I spent in San Jose at the home of David Friedman. Milton Friedman was there, Rose Friedman was there, Aaron Director was there, Robin Hanson was there, and all David's kids. It was a pretty intense event. And in the course of the evening, Milton said, you know, we were all in favor of antitrust regulation in the past, and now none of us are. Isn't that right, Aaron? And Aaron just sort of nodded.
He's 101.
Epstein and Richard provides the argument for Friedman's position on page 193 of Skepticism and Freedom when he's talking about harm without legal injury. Many free market economists have reached the conclusion that in the case of antitrust regulation, even though there are inefficient monopolies, the cure proves worse than the disease. Now I could mention other hard problems, but I want to be clear about what I'm not claiming. I'm not claiming that a lot of the hard problems that Richard brings up have easy answers. A lot of the hard problems that Richard brings up have been the subject of uncountable late-night bull sessions among libertarians since I was in college. And most of them are still unresolved. And one of Richard's most vital services in his work has been sort of to elevate these issues from the level of bull sessions into rich and nuanced legal discourses. So I'm not going to complain about the issues he's not gotten into or not resolved to my satisfaction. What I am complaining about is, or in fact, what I will also say is that one of the most powerful arguments in Richard's book is that the hard problems are at the margin, and that it does not undermine the value of the simple rules that provide straightforward, sensible guidelines for most of human interaction. So my objection to Richard is he doesn't take that advice far enough. He doesn't push the argument far enough, because no matter how many hard cases you can come up with where you might admit individual exceptions to simple rules about coercion, they in no way constitute a justification for a morally and legally privileged institution that's empowered to regularly violate those rules. To regularly do things that no individual or private group is ever entitled to do. And what do we call that institution? We call it the state. And the quintessential privilege is taxation, which when attempted by private individuals is referred to as theft. Now, one can justify government if one is willing to embrace an ancient or medieval worldview which explicitly endorses political hierarchy and privilege, with some people entitled to rule over or enslave others. But what characterizes modernity is the widespread belief in some kind of equality, legal, moral, or otherwise, where every adult individual's preferences count. Now, different political philosophies work that principle out differently, but this is a shared moral premise, shared between Richard and his critics, and therefore, quite properly, he doesn't even bother to defend it. But once you accept this premise, it becomes impossible, in my view, to justify government, which by its nature will violate that premise. The great failed effort of modern political philosophy is to square this circle, is to show how the state gains powers that no individual or group possesses. Some conservatives have abandoned the quest, like James Burdum in a very old book, Congress in the American Tradition, says we can only end up with mystical justifications for the state. The most famous attempt to solve this problem, of course, is Locke's social contract. Richard doesn't adopt that in its strict form, and what he does is he falls back on a consequentialist justification from necessity. Only the state's coercion can provide certain public goods. Now, I accept the force of the public goods argument. In all of its manifestations, there are many situations where self-interested voluntary action does not achieve optimal outcomes, where private gains can lead to net social losses, theft being the perfect example. In fact, one such public good, and arguably the most important, is liberty itself. Creating and maintaining Richard's ideal limited government faces enormous free rider problems, rent seeking, etc. Repealing inefficient taxes is usually a pure public good. If I spend a lot of time working to repeal an inefficient tax that you pay, and I succeed, I can't charge you for the benefits. And thus, we have a suboptimal level of tax repeals under government.
That is true.
And so, as I argued in my review of takings in the Texas Law Review back in 1977, either the public's good problem is decisive or it isn't. And if it's decisive, Richard's limited government is necessary but unattainable. If it's not decisive, Richard's limited government is attainable but unnecessary. If it's not decisive, if people can surmount the free rider obstacle sufficiently to roll back the state to Richard's ideal, they should also be able to provide other public goods as well. As Doug North, the renowned economic historian who emphasizes institutions, has observed, the public goods problem, taken to an extreme, proves too much. It leaves, quote, no way to account for a good deal of the change we observe in history, close quote. And that brings me to the closing of my remarks and to the billing of this talk, The Promised Land of the Free. And strategy, a subject that Richard tries to steer clear of, at least in Skepticism and Freedom. How do you motivate people to eschew the free rider's incentives in order to create either my freer world or Richard's slightly less freer world? And consequentialist arguments are fine. They can be useful. But I think that you shouldn't forget that they can be reinforced with moral arguments based on shared moral premises. In my opinion, the most impressive achievement of classical liberalism is not the United States Constitution, which has become the sacred text of America's political religion. Everybody invokes it, no one follows it. The most impressive and enduring accomplishment of classical liberalism was the abolition of chattel slavery in the 19th century. And in fact, it was so impressive and so enduring that we sometimes underestimate the significance of it. We forget that slavery was a labor system that was ubiquitous on every continent, in every civilization. And then, within a little more than 100 years, we achieved a world where slavery still exists clandestinely in certain areas, but where no ruler, no matter how brutal or dictatorial, would dare get up and publicly defend owning another human being. And how was that done? It wasn't efficiency arguments. Economic historians today are still debating whether slavery was efficient or inefficient. Now, I have my own opinions on that issue. The major ingredient was moral appeals. The moral appeals of the radical radical abolitionists who believed in self-ownership, who condemned slavery as morally wrong, referred to it as man-stealing. And I think that's an important lesson for how the kind of moral arguments that will help us achieve a freer world. Taxation is theft. That is a powerful moral statement. Everybody understands the argument. Right? And if they don't understand it, you can start with rape, right? Is rape okay if one person does it? No. Is it okay if five people do it? Is it okay if we vote to do it? Why is taking money different? Now, once understanding the argument, people do not embrace it because they think that taxation is a practical necessity, as does Richard. And so we also need to supplement the moral argument with empirical studies about doing without taxations for providing a lot of these services, which I think exist. But the fact that we need these empirical studies is no reason to abandon the moral high ground. And unless you want to remain stuck in the gravity well of the client-centered power broker welfare warfare state of today, you are going to need to motivate people with more than cost-benefit analyses. For in strategy as elsewhere, it's simple rules for a complex world that work best. Thank you very much.